Never mind. Okay.
Hello and welcome to the Four Wheel Dive Podcast. I'm Tim Masso, he's Kyle Lindsay. The drive and dive starts now. Right, so this is a topic near and dear to our hearts this week. We're talking about our favorite car movies, our favorite movie cars, and where cars have also found their way to the small screen. We're going to talk about our favorite TV cars. Kyle, lead off, because this topic is potentially endless.
Oh, man. As a car enthusiast, my deep love of cars originally came from all these movies and shows. I'll probably go out the gate swinging with the Fast and the Furious.
Okay, that's an interesting one. Go for it, because I've got a fun postscript to this story, and I guarantee you, there's no way you're going to cover what I'm going to say.
But okay, very cool. So I am a massive fan of the earlier in the Fast saga, as they call it nowadays. The first, second, and third are very near and dear to my heart, but the first one in particular, between that Skyline and the Supra and just all of these cars that basically have created an unobtainable marketplace of iconic JDM cars nowadays.
Yes.
But that was like one of my inspirations for wanting to build my 89 Nissan 240SX. Like, I wanted to put an RB in it. I wanted it to sound like Brian's Skyline and stuff, with, even though that was an RB26. Like, I have seen that movie more times than I could count, and I love it every single time.
It was a great snapshot of a moment. Like, you look at a movie like American Graffiti, or even like The Blob from the 1950s, and you had like a snapshot of what hot rod culture looked like after World War II in those first three decades after the war. And it was deuce coupes, and it was, street rods, and it was all Americana and Detroit iron. And by 2001, when The Fast and the Furious came out, it was a completely different scene. It was import tuners. It was front-wheel drive. It was still Southern California speed shops, but it was a very different scene, a different generation. A lot of cars coming from a four-cylinder background, not V8s, like alien to the old hot rodder.
Well, a lot of things too, like, Hondas were real, real big back in that day because they were cheap, plentiful. I mean, anybody can build a Honda just about. So you saw that kind of stuff everywhere, but you saw a huge amount of like a resurgence of the car culture community, even though it looked so different from like what you're talking about with all the iconic cars from American Graffiti. It was a very different scene, but at the same time, it was all the same, just for a new generation.
Yeah, that's definitely true. You still had the outlaw element. You still had people who were outside the mainstream of society, like Polite Company. They were not racing in back alleys or side streets or, just outside the city limits back in 99, 2000, 2001. It was still kind of like the outlaw youth element. But then, you look at the style of it, you look at the ground effects lights, you look at the wings, you look at the colors of the cars, you look at the way they're making power, and it was just a very moment in time type of movie. The aesthetic of the Fast and the Furious was just solidly import tuners, hot rods, Southern California, West Coast. And the strange thing about it is it didn't stay that way. The progression of the series, like at the beginning, that movie was like what made the phrase like, 2JZ GTE famous. But by the end of the series, it was like the Charger from that first movie that was the star car. Like that famous like drag race between, Brian and the Supra and, the old school 440, I guess it was probably like a 426 Hemi with like, a blower. But the idea, the Charger RT against the Supra, and it was like past versus the future. And it was like a passing of the torch. you know, Toretto versus like, you know, Brian. And by the time the Fast and the Furious reached like the last three installments, it's all about muscle cars. That import tuner scene is barely there.
I know. And it's so unfortunate. Like, you know, I guess because of that time period being just so near and dear to me, like I love seeing that stuff. Like, you know, I remember back in like high school and college, people would start making fun of it, you know, the whole quote unquote ricer crowd and, yeah, and all that stuff. Like, you know, it was just fun. You know, I actually, on like a little random side note, so I do plan on doing some kind of underglow to the 240 because that's awesome to me, but I've got this digital dashboard in the car that I custom installed from Haltech. And whenever I hit my RPM limiter in it, I actually programmed it to flash danger to manifold on the display. Like Brian's Eclipse in the first movie.
I loved that Eclipse. The Eclipse was, you see, unfortunately got blown up, but I loved the Eclipse so much. That was my favorite car in the first movie. Yeah, but it got torched. And it led to people believing that like nitrous oxide in your car was like carrying around a nuke because, you know, it blew up in this like explosion of colorful flames. Like, oh man, if you're running NOS, your car's like a bomb. But it was fun.
It was just so extra.
It was part of the spectacle of the movie. Like there was the element that was rooted in reality. And then there was other stuff like ripping off moving trucks, driving under semi-trailers. Like there was a bunch of stuff that was also like
your forehand falling off when you're hitting the rev limiter.
Yeah, exactly. All that stuff. You know, it was still sort of like you were watching a comic book, but it wasn't like you were watching a cartoon. And by the time you've got submarines chasing hot rods with the Fast and the Furious series, you've kind of lost me.
Yeah, I'm good on that.
Okay, fair enough. But, you know, the funny thing is, like, at the time, I, like, regretted that that awesome Charger didn't have, like, a bigger role in the movie. Now it's in every movie, so, you know, be careful what you wish for.
Because Dodge is a sponsor.
That's true. But, you know, now the Fast and the Furious, other than the crazy stuff like space cars, you know, the stuff that happens on Earth, it's like leaving any given Cars and Coffee. It's all like Challengers and Chargers and Hellcats. But oh, here's the part I wanted to add at the end.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so if you watched Speed Vision in the late 90s, and you guys probably remember Speed Vision. If you're of my generation, like an older millennial, you remember there was this awesome channel that was nothing but racing, like 1960s Grand Prix replays, American Muscle Car, Victory by Design, and a show called Lost Drive-In, where Bruce Dern would kind of meander through these monologues in between features that were old, like 50s, 60s, and 70s car movies. And so this was how I first saw Vanishing Point, but more on that in a moment. There was this one night when the movie was called The Fast and the Furious. And it was a very old movie from 1954 involving a guy who is an outlaw trying to get across the border in like a Jaguar XK whose driver he had like taken sort of like hostage. Like he was using her as his ticket. She was in this road rally. And the road rally crossed from America to like Mexico. And this was like his attempt to get across the border without being noticed, like stowing away with this like road rally. Okay. It's a bad movie. It was, you know, it's typical like 50s, you know, a B movie fare. Nothing spectacular there except the name. And I thought to myself as a kid in high school, you know what they're going to do? Someone's going to take this movie, strip away everything but the name and do a remake. And I just had this feeling in my gut. And then one night I'm at the movie theater. I don't know what I just saw, but I remember the poster, Coming, The Fast and the Furious. And it was the whole cast and it was the cars. And I'm like, it happened. So go on Wikipedia, The Fast and the Furious. The first one, we always think it was 2001. It was 1954. And it was nothing like what you're imagining.
That is so cool.
It absolutely, and the car was a Jaguar XK. I think it was like a Jaguar XK 120. That was the original Fast and the Furious car, and everyone's forgotten it for a reason. It wasn't a great movie, but it's great trivia.
Wow.
Okay, so I have to admit that my favorite car, my favorite movie car, is also my favorite car movie. Because there's a certain kind of Mopar guy where if you say OA5599, he already remembers that was the license plate from the Alpine White Challenger RT in Vanishing Point. And I don't really know how you describe Vanishing Point as a movie. It's existentialist. It's got a lot of, like, I think you could say it's a Western in its own way, in its own funny way. It's a car movie, but it's also not a car movie. There's a lot of Christian symbolism. It's the kind of movie that you finish watching and you just sit there and you think about it and you think about it. And 20 years after I first saw it, and it was on the Lost Drive-In with Bruce Dern, I saw it on Speed Vision, I'm still thinking about this movie. And I'm not, spoiler alert, it doesn't have a happy ending, but I'm not going to give away the ending specifically. But it's about a guy. It's basically a movie about nothing and what happens along the way. A guy who is like a burned out cop who tried to do the right thing, was exiled from the force, went to Vietnam, came back, found nothing for him in the States, had a girl, lost the girl, she died. And he had a driving career as like, you know, a racer, but he never made it. And now he basically is a car delivery driver. And he bets the guy who hooks him up with the delivery car that he can drive from the pickup point to California in some ridiculously short period. And if he does, the guy who hooks him up with the cars will also hook him up with drugs. And so that's the beginning. And so he's on drugs the whole movie. And so the whole thing has the feel of like a drug-induced haze. The movie itself is 98 minutes, of which about 96 minutes is a car chase. And he meets all of these like outsiders along the way. People in the desert, nudists, hippies, snake wranglers, hitchhikers. And it's just like a cross section of people outside the mainstream of society. And of course he is as well. And through the course of the movie, a bigger and bigger police chase builds up trying to track this guy down. And that's sort of the story. But he's like a cowboy. He's like an outlaw. They call him the last American hero because there's a radio DJ who's following the whole proceedings, listening in on cop radios and narrating for an audience that increasingly follows this car chase. And it's just blazing fast driving by Kerry Lofton, who was the stunt driver who famously did the 10-minute sequence in Bullet. So 95% of the driving you see is Kerry Lofton, who's probably the greatest ever vehicular stuntman. Like when you're looking at a car chase movie made in the 60s or 70s, it's like a 9 out of 10 chance he's doing the driving. And the cars were great. They were all Challenger RTs. They had 5 of them, all Alpine White. And so 4 of them were 440s with manual transmissions. And then there was a 383 with an automatic. If they ever needed to do like a close-up of the actor driving, they would use like the 383 because it was an auto, he could drive it. And unlike Bullet, where they've actually found the car, they found one of the Bullet Mustangs, and it sold for like almost $4 million at auction. No one has ever found a confirmed Vanishing Point Challenger.
Oh, wow.
As far as I can tell, no one's even got a candidate because the cars were all borrowed and then given back. And it is unlike Bullet, where you forget what the movie is about, but you remember the car chase. At Vanishing Point, you never forget the movie. It's got like a haunting quality to it. It was one of the inspirations behind the movie Baby Driver from 2017, which is definitely on my list. Quentin Tarantino actually made a tribute of it that was part of the Grindhouse double feature in 2007. They actually had the car from the movie, not the car, but one like it. And Steven Spielberg said it was one of his favorite movies ever. So it's like not just a B movie, it's got a great legacy as a good movie. Film classes study it, but you'll never forget it because it's got jumps, it's got chases, it's got burnouts. It's got awesome long shots of the car, like 160 through the Southwest desert. It's just a beautifully ambiguous movie, and you never forget it or the car or the driver.
I'm almost ashamed to say I've never seen it. I'm going to have to add it to my list.
add it to the list. It's the only art house movie on this list because most car movies are not also like great movies. This one was. This one really was.
Well, it's kind of like American Graffiti. That movie was kind of about nothing. It was just about the culture at the time of, you know, cruising downtown. There were all the friends hanging out and stuff, and, you know, just, you know, almost like a coming of age movie, so to speak, where it was just literally a snapshot of the time.
Yeah, it was Americana. That's the thing. It was like, well, what do teenagers do before they go off to war, before they go off to school? Like, that's what they do, like back in the early 70s. And Vanishing Point was almost like, well, what happens after the person, what happens after youth is over? What happens with disillusionment? Because the guy was a cop, but he burned out as a cop. The guy was a driver, but he burned out as a driver. He went to Vietnam and he found nothing when he came back. But it was also the era after, like the hippie era. Like the 60s had failed. It was over. And the 70s was like an era of disillusionment. And in Vanishing Point, with police and state troopers and religious authorities, there's a lot of irreverence and kind of almost a warning about authority figures. It's like, it's a very anti-authority movie about self-reliance and alienation. And although it is like a 98-minute car chase, there's a lot more to it. And I keep going back to the movie to the point where I've probably seen it now 20 times, and I'm still not sure how to interpret the ending. I'm not sure if it's a happy ending or an unhappy ending. You're going to have to see it. You're going to have to watch this movie.
We'll talk about it on a future one.
We will. There was an awful made-for-TV remake. Skip that one, please.
Okay. Please. Good to know.
All right. What else have you got for me, Kyle?
Probably my favorite series of car movies outside of the Fast and the Furious. Sorry about that.
You see, guys, the podcast is as real as it gets, including dial tones.
It's weird because I turn my phone off and my computer starts ringing still.
it's like all these devices are connected or something, you know?
It's like, y'all leave me alone, please. Anyway, so aside from the Fast and the Furious, my favorite series of, I mean, it's not really car movies, but the car is the main star of the movie, and that's Back to the Future. So, yeah. Back to the Future, obviously, trilogy. The first one is iconic. I love the second and third ones as well. But it's really cool because, you know, 1981 DeLorean DMC-12, one of the most iconic cars of all times. Not because of a performance standpoint or anything like that, but really because of the story surrounding the car itself, with, you know, John DeLorean and starting the company and the crazy drug stuff that happened later. But that's not the whole point of what I'm talking about. But
I feel it too. I feel the same way you do about these movies.
Right. And it's so cool because, you know, what Doc Brown was talking about and how he used the DeLorean as the ideal time machine with the stainless steel body and all that stuff, you start really like buying into the idea like that actually kind of makes sense. Like, somebody should build a time machine out of a DeLorean.
And thank goodness they did, because it could have been a lot worse. The initial idea was that it would be a pickup truck. And as they got closer and closer to actually, you know, calling the people who procure Hollywood cars, and they realized they were going to have to build up, you know, they're going to have a couple of different versions of whatever they chose to build. There was a change in the process to make it a DeLorean. And, you know, when asked why, the set designers and the writers and the producers said, well, we put the clue in the movie when he said, if you're going to make a time machine, do it with some style. And at some point, we realized that a pickup truck wasn't going to get it done, but they still got the pickup truck into the movie with that black Toyota Hilux pickup. So they still did feature the pickup they had in mind, just not as the time machine.
Oh, that thing was so gorgeous. It's good luck finding one in good shape nowadays, though.
You'll find no shortage of tribute versions to them on Bring a Trailer, though. Not the real thing, but ones that are made up to look like the real thing.
And it's cool too because the DeLorean underwent such big changes between, you know, the first, second, and third movies too. With, you know, in the second movie, Brown upgraded to the Mr. Fusion system, so the car, you know, was a bit more efficient, so to speak, and could just run on pretty much anything. And then, in the third one, they had to use the train power to get it pushed. But
here's the thing. A lot of people are very critical of the series because they'll say that the second movie was the low point. I thought that the second movie was breathtaking in its ambition. They're like, okay, we're going to dovetail in the first movie at the beginning, the third movie at the end. We're going to take place in 1985, 2015, and 1955. There's going to be two Docs and two Martys in 1955. It's amazing that the whole thing came together. And there were two Docs and two Martys, I guess two Jennifers and two Martys in 2015. But it was an amazingly ambitious movie, and I genuinely loved the Flying DeLorean. When I remember the car, I remember that version of it.
I don't understand why anybody would say that, because I agree with you. The complexity of the second one was really cool. But if you look back at it too, like 2015, what they were projecting, what it would be, it's so hilarious.
In some ways it's better, in some ways it's worse. Like, our computer graphics are a lot better than they expected. Flying cars and hoverboards are a lot worse.
We don't have flying fox body Mustangs.
And my jacket does not dry itself. But, you know, the other thing, too, was like the second one was a lot darker than the first one. The second one was like, well, you know, let's look at the dangers of time travel more deeply. And I don't think there's any greater shock in the series than when Marty goes back to the alternative version of 1985 and Sammy Hagar is playing. And you're like, you know, there's like biker gangs and toxic waste and bedlam in the streets. And Biff is the most powerful man in the country. And his father, I mean, it was shocking that they pulled all that off. That could have been a movie by itself. That was like, that was just the second act.
Absolutely.
But yeah, again, the flying time machine was, in my opinion, the coolest version, because it had all the capability from the first movie. It had the fusion and the flight. And, you know, also I had like a Revell like model of that car when I was a kid. And I think you have a soft spot for everything that you had as a 1/18 scale model when you're a kid. And that is no exception.
Well, I'm going to interject another one going off of that, because I did have a model of this at one point.
Go for it.
The 59 Cadillac Miller Meteor from Ghostbusters 1 and 2.
Ooh.
And, well, technically, ooh. Ghostbusters Afterlife, which I want to talk about Afterlife in just a second.
Spoiler alert, Tim hasn't seen the movie.
Okay, I will give no spoilers.
Perfect.
Aside from the car obviously reappearing, but you see that in the trailer.
It's on the movie poster, though, and the trailer, so we know that. That's not going to break.
I'll tell you what. Afterlife, I didn't see the Ghostbusters that was in the middle, like with the girl cast. I hadn't seen that one. That one was kind of like the outlier, I guess.
I didn't see that one either. I think the movie, I think a couple of Ghostbusters, the firehouse and the car, make a cameo, though. So,
okay, interesting.
If you're a really dedicated Ghostbuster fan, let us know in the comments below whether you saw that one.
Yeah, that sounds good. I will say, so I love the scene in the first movie when they first pick up the car and it's all smoking and backfire and it pulls into the firehouse and Dan Aykroyd is like, oh, it needs this and 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 this. And this. It's like an endless list. And then all of a sudden, like a few scenes later, you get that roar of that big Cadillac. I guess it was a 390 or something like that. And it was just game over from there. I was like, oh man, that's the coolest hearse, ambulance, whatever I've ever seen.
Yeah, for years, and it's good that you mentioned that. I thought for years that it was a hearse, and it seems to fit that the Ghostbusters would have a hearse, but it's actually an ambulance. And
yep.
I can't imagine a world in which it seems logical for EMTs or a fire department or a hospital to start with a 59 Cadillac and end with an ambulance.
I know, instead of like a Ford Econoline or something like that nowadays.
That's like a CT6V like gets turned into an ambulance today.
The 50s were way cooler than...
People had nerve back then. Even the ambulance had tail fins. If that's going to be your last ride, whether it's a hearse or an ambulance, you're going out in style.
Well, I'm not going to give you any spoilers of Afterlife, but I will say, when the car made its reappearance, I got chills unlike anything I've gotten chills with a movie before. Oh man, I was just gripping my seat. It was awesome.
Oh my gosh. Okay, well then I have to see it. But I also am going to add that being a few years older than you, Kyle, I'm one of those Xennials, one of the guys who's on like the like fissure between, you know, like Generation X and the Millennials. So I can remember when there was also a Ghostbusters cartoon in the late 80s, early 90s, and the car was in that too. So I remember it equally from the cartoon and from the movies.
That's cool.
Yeah, so if you've seen, you probably saw the cartoon. If you're between, if you're a car guy between like 35 and 45, you probably saw the cartoon at some point. So check that out. I think you can still find it on YouTube, pirated.
I'm gonna look that up. I hadn't seen that either.
There was an awesome like 1/12 scale model of Echo One. That was the name. It had a name. It was Echo One that you can still find on eBay. It was a kid's toy back in the day. It's like the ultimate short of like a set used proton pack prop. It's like the ultimate Ghostbusters fan collectible.
That's sweet.
Okay, so here's one for me. GoldenEye. It was the first Pierce Brosnan Bond and the best by a mile.
One of my favorites.
Probably one of the best Bond movies ever. It deserves to be up there with Thunderball and Goldfinger. It was legitimately, you know, with Casino Royale. But here's the thing. I'm not here to talk about the BMW Z3, which was every inch the expensive Miata they made it out to be with its original four-cylinder engine in 1995. I'm here to talk about the T-55 Soviet tank from the Moscow chase sequence.
Yes!
You remember that? Oh my gosh.
Dude, I love GoldenEye. Everything about it, the game, the soundtrack, it's the best.
The game, by the way, again, if you are of a certain generation, you will have played that game until your controllers were worn out on Nintendo 64.
I still have one. I have a game, vintage game station, and I still play it because, again, it's amazing.
So there is this scene where Bond, like right after the scene in the prison, Urumarov is, you know, he's the evil general. He's trying to make his escape with Natalia, and Bond escapes from the prison and commandeers a Soviet era T-55 tank. And there is a car chase through the streets of Moscow where the general is taking repeated hits on his vodka in his flask because Bond keeps getting closer and closer in the tank, running over cars parked, breaking through alleys by moving aside the buildings if necessary. And then there's one just crashing through and destroying all sorts of stuff. And it's a tank, so you believe it. But there's one scene which is physically impossible, but looks totally convincing when you watch the movie, where he actually does like a drift slide in the tank around a corner. That's so impossible. Watch it and you believe it because it was done so well. And that's got to be the highlight of the scene. Other than maybe the part where he uses the tank and it's cannon, you're waiting the whole time for him to fire the cannon. And finally, he does use the cannon to derail a whole train. So it's like the money shot at the end and you get your money's worth. It's so good. Other than maybe the original DB5 in Goldfinger or Thunderball, I think that's my favorite ever Bond car chase. It's very special.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, going off of the DB5, they brought that back for the Daniel Craig era, which is a very – I am a huge Bond fan. We should do – I wish that we could definitely do a Bond episode because there's so many – iconic cars throughout the Bond series. But it was really cool when they brought that back for the Craig era. I shed a tear when they shot it all up that one time, but it keeps getting reborn in every movie, it seems. So it's fine. Q Branch is on point.
Here's the other thing I'll mention. They did actually have the DB5 in Goldfinger. Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned this. Right at the beginning in the Pierce Brosnan series, it's portrayed as his personal car. So that's how they got away with using it, even though BMW was paying the bills for the first three Brosnan Bonds. So right at the beginning, and I'm not making this up, guys, if you haven't seen the movie, there's this femme fatale and her character name is Zina Onatopp, and that's her real name in the movie. I didn't make that up. But there is a chase involving her in a Ferrari 355 and Bond is in a car chase, like playfully chasing her down a mountain pass in the DB5, which makes no sense because a DB5 from the 60s couldn't chase a 1995 355. But again, you buy it because he's Bond, and of course he's able to keep up. But they get the DB5 in there, and I'll say this, the DB5 in GoldenEye probably gets more screen time than it got in Goldfinger or Thunderball. So the movie's worth seeing for that. So there was actually an Aston Martin car chase in GoldenEye. GoldenEye has it all, guys. You've got to see it. If you haven't, do it tonight. All right. So we've done Vanishing Point, Back to the Future, GoldenEye, The Fast and the Furious. What else have you got on your list?
Christine.
How did I not think of Christine? Oh, my gosh.
58 Plymouth Fury. And, you know, I'm almost embarrassed to say that I have only seen that movie recently. Probably with it was maybe like 6 months or so ago. I don't know why it took me so long, but that movie's amazing. If you haven't seen it, I won't give you any spoilers and stuff, but you basically, the movie starts out at the production, the Fury production line, and some stuff goes down and you start thinking like, oh man, this is going to get crazy and stuff. But basically the car is left to rot. This young kid buys it, fixes it up, and then all hell breaks loose. But that car is beautiful. There's actually one that comes to a local cruise in every now and then. It's not red, it's blue, but I'm telling you what, the late 50s Mopars, there's just something about them that, you know, nothing from GM and Ford really came close to the intricacy and the creativity and just the sheer grandiose styling that they had. It was awesome.
We will do a whole episode on car style, and I will talk about Virgil Exner, who's a hero of mine. He was responsible for all those 57 Mopars, and I guess retroactively, he was then responsible for all of the overstyled 1958 Fords and GMs that tried to respond to the 57 Mopars. But those cars from 57 just looked so mean. Oh my gosh. Every single one of them looked the part of a movie monster. And I don't think anyone was as mean looking as like the 57 Plymouth Belvedere or Fury. And that's what you get in Christine. And it's interesting to me because this is a movie directed by John Carpenter when he was the king of horror. Like he was to directing horror movies what Stephen King was to writing horror novels. And the combination of the two makes for a truly great horror movie. And, you know, it's also great because you can watch it with friends. You can watch it with like your girlfriend. It's not like you're watching, I don't know, The Thing by John Carpenter, which is like so intense that some people can't deal with it. You know, Christine's not that scary, but it grabs you and it sort of loops you into its world where halfway through it seems totally logical that this vindictive, like self-possessed car is killing people.
Yeah. And the special effects were amazing for how old of a movie it is.
Yeah. Like it took me a long time to figure out how they did. Like, here's the thing, spoiler alert. I've in the book, and there is a book recommended, guys. The book is a somewhat different story. I actually think that John Carpenter did a good job rewriting the book for the screen. And I think the movie is better than the book, but I recommend you check out both. If you're a car guy, you'll like both, but Christine can repair herself. So if you've ever wondered why they don't just smash the car up, well, the car can fix itself. And they do this graphically in the movie. And you always wonder, well, okay, how did they do this? The car is smashed. It's a real Plymouth Fury. You already know that when you crease metal, you can't uncrease it. Even a body shop can't do that. When you break glass, you can't unbreak it. So what they did was they had 16 cars for the movie. And some of them were fitted with hydraulic rams inside them. So when the hydraulic rams were activated, the car would crush itself. And so the scene where the damaged Christine was reconstituting itself, where even the glass went back together, that was the scene of the hydraulic crush played in reverse.
Oh, wow.
Yes. That's how they did it.
Mind blown. That makes so much sense.
And that's why it looks so good, because it's real. None of it is a model. None of it is a prop. It's a real car being uncrushed.
Holy cow. I'm going to have to rewatch it now just so I can watch it with that new appreciation.
And here's the other thing, too. Like, Christine, like the red and the white Fury, in the book, the car is a 57, but I think in the movie it was a 58, because the 57 had the false quadruple headlights. Fun fact, but back in 1957, you couldn't have quad headlights in all the states in the country. So preemptively, Chrysler built a lot of cars like the Fury, where you would have some sort of an indicator light inboard of the outer lights, which were the real lights. For 58, they got true double headlights. And with some of the quad headlight cars, like the 300 and the Imperials, there's actually big single headlight 57 Mopars out there. But they used a 58 for the movie. And then the Fury was only ever available in a sort of tan and like sand coloration. So like white and almost like sand tan. They didn't make any white red cars like that. So the car in the movie is a little bit fanciful because you couldn't get your 58 Fury like that. But a hell of a lot have been restored that way because of the movie.
Man, that's so cool.
And there's a reason they never gave it the Hemi. Because in 1957, if they gave the Fury, which was a much lighter car, the 392 Hemi from the New Yorker and the 300C and the Imperials, it would have been so much faster than the 300 that no one would have bought the 300. As it is, if you get a 57 or a 58 with the Golden Commando, you're getting 300 horsepower in a 50s ride, and they weigh a hell of a lot less than you think they do because they've got no safety features.
it's just a different experience.
it is, definitely. Thank you so much for mentioning Christine. Oh, guys, fun fact. Grand Theft Auto has this immersive environment called Grand Theft Auto Online, and for the last 2 years, if you were in Grand Theft Auto Online, they had these Halloween events that would occur during nighttime in the game. One of them was a clown slasher. One of them was like a chainsaw massacre type guy with like a sack over his head. And one of them was the flaming car from the gas station scene in Christine.
Oh.
They called it the Phantom Car because they couldn't call it Christine, but it was a 1950s style red and white tail finned flaming killer car with no driver. And it is by far the toughest monster in the Halloween version of Grand Theft Auto Online. Almost impossible to kill, and it will run you over and set you on fire, and it will tar and feather your ass. So check out. Go online and like type in on YouTube Phantom Car Grand Theft Auto Online. You could see their version of Christine.
I'm going to do it.
Definitely do it. Definitely do it. Okay. So if you loved Vanishing Point in 1971, but you weren't an existentialist or an anti-authority figure, or you just like happier endings, then I recommend the first full-length film ever directed by Steven Spielberg, initially directed by Spielberg for TV and later released in theaters. It is Duel.
Hmm.
And Duel was his first ever full-length film directed. And I would say that it was the beginning of that 70s era car as monster trend. So the 70s brought us Christine, the book. We also got The Car, which The Car is like another killer car movie. It's not nearly as good.
I've seen that.
A 4 a.m. type of movie, you know.
Yeah.
4 a.m. on cable, that sort of thing.
I can't unhear the horn from that car.
I think that was a Lincoln Mark III, I think. It was a modified Lincoln Mark III. But yeah, I can't unhear the horn either. But Duel was a truck. Duel was, I think, a Peterbilt 351. And the idea was there's this man who's kind of like he's got like a failing relationship. He's an office worker. He's got a wimpy kind of demeanor. He's got a wimpy kind of car. It's a Plymouth Valiant. And he's out on two-lane blacktop in the middle of nowhere, heading through the desert outside of like the cities in California. And, you know, if you go outside of San Diego a few miles, you're in the desert. So it's set in that kind of environment. and he's preyed upon by this smoke, dirt, and oil-covered Peterbilt 351 diesel pulling a tanker. And the you never really see the driver. Spielberg wanted to emphasize the truck as both the antagonist and a monster. So just as Christine was kind of like a slasher movie with the car as the slasher, Duel was a monster movie with the truck as the monster. And Spielberg actually had a casting call with a bunch of trucks. And he wanted to, he didn't care what kind of car Dennis Weaver was driving as the man who's evading the truck. He didn't care what kind of car it was, but he wanted a truck that looked like a monster. And so he eventually found one. And pardon me, I think it was a Peterbilt 281, not a 351. And then they had the set department and the prop department make it uglier and uglier. And so they just kept adding bugs and oil and smoke and just making it look really weathered. And then the sort of like crowning grace of all of this was that you had all of these license plates on the front of the truck from a bunch of different states. And it was designed to suggest that the truck was like a serial killer and a trophy hunter. And these are all the drivers that it had killed before. And right up to the end of the movie, you've got this cat and mouse between this kind of like dopey loser of a guy in his Plymouth Valiant and this menacing big rig. And it is a great movie.
That sounds cool. It sounds really familiar. I thought it was called something else, but I guess I've obviously confused it with something else.
There might have been, I'm trying to remember, there was a truck movie. There was like a monster. There was like a truck antagonist movie called Black Dog in the 90s. That might be what you're thinking of.
Maybe. Yeah.
Or maybe you're thinking of the music video from Metallica's Enter Sandman, where the kid dreams that he's being chased by a big rig. Maybe you're thinking of that.
Well, speaking of ugly vehicles, I got something for you.
Go for it.
Breaking Bad.
Oh,
Pontiac Aztec.
Oh, the Pontiac Aztec. I thought this was going to be the motorhome.
The motorhome is pretty cool, but it was that Pontiac Aztec that they used for so many seasons until it got the end it deserved.
And, you know, the thing too was they did like a casting call for vehicles for that series too. And they're like, well, this Heisenberg persona is menacing, evil, ruthless. But Walter White is a habitual loser. So that's how they picked the Pontiac Aztec. They're like, what better characterizes him than a Pontiac Aztec?
I was looking over to my wife because her mom used to have an Aztec and they loved it. So I always poke fun. But it was actually kind of neat. And if you want to see a modern interpretation of an Aztec, you can look at the Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross.
Yes. Ooh, that's a good point.
Now you can't unsee it, can you?
No. Ooh.
You're welcome.
No. Gratefully accepted. When you talk about Breaking Bad, I thought it was going to be the Fleetwood motorhome. And I know, like, sometimes, you know, set designers and prop departments box themselves into a corner because they pick something off a lot. And then they realize that they accidentally pick something that's super rare and hard to find. Like in the movie Tremors, I think they had an SJ Cherokee like pickup, like a Jeep pickup SJ series, I think it was. And they're like, once we tried to find more than one of those, we realized that they just don't exist, but we'd already shot half the movie. So we had to go out and build them from parts. And so the motorhome in Breaking Bad, because they established that this was the meth lab. And once they had done that, they realized they couldn't find another one that looked exactly like it because it was so old and people generally ordered custom options, so no two were alike. But yeah, the Aztec, the motorhome, and then for a period there was a Wagoneer in there. And
I appreciate that.
Well,
those have really come up. We talked about that in one of the other episodes of how popular they've become and like a cult classic.
Yeah, like now people pay big money for restored Wagoneers. And I think if you drove a Wagoneer 25 years ago, it would have been seen as almost like something, you know, you drive because you can't afford a Grand Cherokee Overland. Whereas today, you know, you've got a Wagoneer. That's the coolest thing parked in front of the hottest restaurant in LA. Like you get, you show up in like a 458 or a 488. You know, the valet doesn't even look at your Ferrari. You show up in a Wagoneer. The more wood, the more fake wood, the better. He's parking that out front.
How about growing up? I was a huge fan of the original Dukes of Hazzard series.
Oh, yeah. This is a good one because there's a backstory to this that you're going to love. But definitely, you got to tell me about this because I never followed the series. I didn't discover it until I was an older person.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously it ran for a bunch of seasons, and then the car was a 69 Charger, one of the best looking Chargers ever, and bright orange and all the decals and whatnot. And it just made me think of it the other day. There's actually a extremely authentic reproduction car in town that somebody has built with all the livery and the correct colors and mods and everything like that. It's a pretty car. But the only, probably the only downside, they destroyed a lot of Chargers throughout the series. And even in the reboot, the movie with Johnny Knoxville and all them, it wasn't quite the campy, you know, innocent series that it originally was, but it was also quite entertaining because that car, they had a lot of fun with that thing.
Yeah, I would say conservatively between the show, the made-for-TV movies, the reboot, the cinematic adaptation with Johnny Knoxville, they probably destroyed around 100 Chargers, which makes me cry a tear. But they died heroes, so there's that. That's your
absolutely. I mean, you can't have Dukes of Hazzard without jumping a creek bed or something like that.
And here's the thing. I grew up in the North, so I had limited exposure to the Dukes of Hazzard. Culturally, it wasn't the same thing. So for years, you know, we had this restaurant called Roy Rogers, and there used to be a TV cowboy named Roy Rogers. And so one of his ventures was that he added his name to a chain of fast food restaurants. And it wasn't just like McDonald's or Burger King's. You could get like fried chicken. You could get like a roast beef sandwich. It was more interesting than that. But they had the same kind of idea where there's like a Happy Meal type thing for little kids. And I had this orange Matchbox car that I got out of one of those Roy Rogers kids meals. And for years, I didn't know what that was all about. I never knew where that came from or what it was supposed to be. And then as more or less a high schooler, I learned, oh, it's the Dukes of Hazzard. It was this show that was on at the same time as Knight Rider. It's just culturally, my part of the country didn't really get it. So I had this little General Lee, and I never knew where it came from, but I found out more or less as a high school kid.
Did you grow up watching Andy Griffith?
Again, this is the kind of thing I discovered later in life because I grew up with Andy Griffith on Nick at Night.
Okay. So Mayberry is only about 35 minutes from where I live currently. They actually have Andy Griffith Parkway. Like I'm drawing a blank. Mount Airy, North Carolina. When you go to Mount Airy, North Carolina, you can go down Andy Griffith Parkway. There's a restaurant called Aunt B's. There's a lot of like really cool things like tribute in the show in that area. But the sheriff car, I think it was a 1960 or 62 Ford Galaxy, the one that Andy drove basically the entire series. That was one of my favorite shows growing up, and that there wasn't a whole lot of like cars and stuff in that, but that sheriff car was pretty cool. It was very, very basic. It shows how things have changed over the years when it comes to squad cars.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're moving into like the EV era of squad cars very, very soon. So it's amazing to think that like once upon a time, you had only one car featured in one of the most popular shows. Back when there were three channels on TV, you had a car featured in one of the most popular shows on one of those three channels. And it probably wasn't even like product placement. They hadn't even like thought of that yet. They're probably just like, well, what do cops drive? Oh, okay, this, fine, let's get one of those.
Yeah, pretty much.
Fun backstory to the Dukes of Hazzard. Now, because I'm a Mopar guy, I know this. So, when they were originally coming up with the concept for the series, they had a real life inspiration. And there was a guy named Jerry Rushing, and he was a moonshiner. And he was born into a family business that made illegal whiskey. And, you know, he would evade the revenue agents on Thunder Road, carrying this stuff tax-free in a Chrysler 300D, which was the 1958 version of the 300C. 392 Hemi. He had it geared for 150 miles an hour. This was back when you could order whatever rear end you wanted in a car. And so he had it geared for maximum speed, like Daytona Flying Mile maximum speed. And with 400 horsepower back then, nothing driven by the feds could catch it. And he had a tank in the back for hundreds of gallons of White Lightning. He had a taillight cutout. He had an oil slick. He had a smoke screen. And all of this in the baddest looking, like 50s Mopar you can imagine. And the car in the Dukes of Hazzard was called the General Lee. But Rushing's car was called Traveler, because that was one of Lee's most famous horses. So they bought the rights to his story. They didn't want to copy it literally, but Traveler became General Lee. And the 1958 300D, at that point in the 70s and 80s, it was so rare that they couldn't even find enough of them in running condition to use as prop cars. So they decided they would use the Charger, because at the time that was a lot easier to find. They could get all those they wanted. And so he really did sign over his life story to the studio that made the show. And they kept the basic outline of this guy being a shine runner in a high-speed Mopar. And there are a couple of episodes of The Dukes of Hazzard where he appears in a cameo as a used car salesman.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so look for Jerry Rushing. He was for years a bit of a mini celebrity. After the show became a hit, he would go to like fan shows and he would sign autographs as like the inspiration for the Dukes of Hazzard. But yeah, his car, Traveler, still exists. A collector owns it. And he actually spent a little bit of time as a stock car driver too. So he's got an all-around interesting story that might even be more interesting than the Dukes themselves.
Wow, that's fascinating.
And it's just a really fun story if you're like a Mopar diehard and you like lose hours of time on Allpar. This is for you. Definitely for you. Okay, so I've got a movie that actually has a lot of cars, most of which are not recognizable, but I loved the Mad Max series as a kid. Mad Max, the first one, I guess I didn't really get it as a kid because it was such a low-budget movie. It had a lot of slow segments between the actions, but they were dealing with a budget of zero. By the time you got to The Road Warrior, oh my gosh, that series had hit its stride. And The Interceptor was just so cool. It was a car we did not have in the United States, but it was also modified to the point that even the Australians wouldn't recognize the Ford on which it was based. It was just super cool. Last of the V8 Interceptors, 600 horsepower. Thunderdome was okay. It was okay for a kid. That's just fine. It had its moments. But Fury Road in 2015, the sequel, the Mad Max 4 that we thought would never happen. And you normally don't talk about a movie part 4 as being the best of the series, but it was. It was one of the best movies of the year. And if you remember the war rig that they drove, it was the huge truck that was designed to go get the gasoline from Gastown. Back when these warlords ruled like the wasteland, you had one place that just made weapons. You had one place that just pumped gas. And, you know, each one of these, like, citadels is ruled by a warlord with his war rigs and his war parties of modified cars that rule the Badlands. And so the war boys have a war rig that's driven by a female amputee, Imperator Furiosa, who's played by Charlize Theron. And she's like an absolute badass who gets double billing with Max himself, and Tom Hardy plays Mad Max. And the movie is just nonstop chasing. So you've got this big rig that she's driving called the War Rig that's got a tanker on the back of it, and there's weapons and there's high-speed chases, and there's modified vehicles, and there's monster trucks, and there's hot rods, and there's nitrous oxide, and there's electrical storms and dust storms and epic stunts, and a lot of it is physical. They had a budget to actually use real cars and trucks for a lot of this. And so if you liked the Vanishing Point car chase as movie idea, where the chase is basically one and the same as the movie, you're going to love this. But it's well casted, beautiful cinematography, epic action, great acting, awesome writing and directing. Check it out. But it's an unexpected, like, female empowerment movie, which it definitely is. But the War Rig is one of the all-time most memorable car chase cars, and it's not a car.
Because I haven't seen it yet. Was that a standalone, or do you need to see the other ones first?
You know, the interesting thing about it is it owes almost nothing to the other Mad Max movies. I would say you don't have to see any Mad Max movies first to see that one, because the first three movies featured Mel Gibson as Max. And of course, this movie taking place so long afterward, it was as much a reboot of the franchise as it was a sequel. And Tom Hardy as Max is not Mel Gibson's Mad Max. So I would definitely say that whereas you almost got to like a almost action comedy type of genre with Mad Max 3, this goes back to being a very serious and hardcore Max, sort of like he appears in Max 1 and Max 2, The Road Warrior. You take everything you loved about the first three Mad Max movies, get rid of the hokey like comedy of the third one, and you get Mad Max 4, which is just super intense. You will conclude that it is a little bit long at 120 minutes, but it doesn't seem that way. It is like breakneck pace. There's cars, there's trucks, there's motorcycles. You get your money's worth.
That's pretty cool. Well, again, I know we're getting a little close to time. I wanted to circle back to American Graffiti right quick.
Definitely.
There were so many iconic vehicles in that movie, but the main one, the yellow car, the 32 Deuce Coupe Ford. Deuce was a nickname, came from, you know, 1932 to Deuce. But that car has played such an iconic role in the hot rod scene over decades. So the car originally, so it started, that's right around when the Ford Flathead V8 came out. So when that motor came out, you know, today, you know, it made like no horsepower. But back then, it was a big deal. You can get to higher speeds and you know, more refinement, more performance, so on and so forth. It got a resurgence in the 50s when, you know, the market started coming down post-war. It was affordable for, you know, young people, first cars and whatnot. And then when American Graffiti, the movie, came out, it was a whole new resurgence for that and a huge, huge boom in the hot rod community because, you know, when you see pictures of the movie car, you know, it doesn't have a hood. You have the exposed engine, you have the radiator shroud, the headlamps, a couple little small braces, and then you have the body with this crazy raked stance and stuff. And that car has served as a model for so many hot rodders, to the point where, you know, it's kind of hard to find original 32 Fords, but there are companies that make reproduction steel bodies and fiberglass bodies for people who not only want to replicate that movie car, but to make it their own and take it to the next level because, you know, it's hard to get more quintessential American hot rod than a two-door flathead V8 with very minimal stuff to it.
Yeah, I would say that I would add that probably the two most famous Deuce Coupes ever are that one from American Graffiti and the supercharged Oldsmobile powered car from the cover of the Beach Boys album Little Deuce Coupe. Those are the most replicated 32 Ford hot rods of all time.
Oh, absolutely. That'd be a lot of fun to build one day.
Oh my gosh. You want to the thing that like brings a tear to my eye? someone bought that car from the cover of the Beach Boys album for like $40,000 in the 90s. It's like the price of a used Audi A4.
It's probably like $250,000 now.
I guarantee you it is priceless. It would go up, on Barrett Jackson on the main stage as like the headline car for like an auction. Oh my gosh.
Wow. But yeah,
I mean, it's funny you mentioned like that American Graffiti era, because initially people had like flathead hop-ups, because the Model 18, which was the V8 version of the 32 Ford, you know, in the 50s and the 40s, you could buy all sorts of aftermarket stuff. Zora Arkus Duntov, the father of the Corvette, made hop-up like cylinder head kits for flathead Fords before he became the lead engineer on the Vette. And then in the late 50s through the 60s, 70s, and even the 80s, that car got a second wind, no longer like a budget hot rod for flathead hop-ups, but it was given a second wind by the arrival of mostly GM overhead valve V8s, which made them as fast as anything that was more modern. And you could throw in a 350 small block or a 303 Oldsmobile. You could add like a YN supercharger. All of a sudden, you know, a Paxton supercharger. All of a sudden, you were competing with any Corvette or Jaguar XKE on pure performance.
Oh, absolutely. Because flathead Fords, you know, I think at their peak only made 110, 115 horsepower, something like that.
Maximum. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you were going to build a flathead Ford the same way you would build a Chevy small block, you're going to spend way more money and get a whole lot less in return. Now, that's performance-wise. A fully built Ford flathead is way cooler than a built Chevy small block, in my opinion.
Yeah,
they just have a unique character all their own, especially if you're able to get like Offenhauser heads and like the aftermarket intakes and stuff like that that I secretly want to do to my 48 one day, but probably never will. But you're absolutely right. The availability and the commonplace of the Chevy small block has widened the appeal of those old cars and made them more drivable, more fun, more attainable, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and American Graffiti, you know, bring it full circle. We talked about how in 2001, the Fast and the Furious was like a snapshot of tuner car culture and Southern California car culture and East Coast and West Coast tuner car culture and street racing culture. American Graffiti was a snapshot of that period of like what they called custom culture, each word with a K. It was cars, it was music, it was art, Big Daddy Roth, Rat Fink. It was everything related to pop culture at the street level. It was music. It was so much more than just cars. But you don't have culture in America without car culture. It's always part of the bigger picture. And American Graffiti really gave us that.
Absolutely. So if you haven't seen either Fast and the Furious and American Graffiti, go for it.
Check out Vanishing Point too, and that includes you, Kyle.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, guys, that has been the Drive and Dive. Time out, Tim out, Kyle out. Thanks for logging on.